benefit of cooperative learning. Indeed, the teachers I met seemed to pay close attention to their students' managerial skills. In one public school I visited in downtown Atlanta, a third-grade teacher pointed out a quiet student who likes to do his own thing. But we put him in charge of safety patrol one morning, so he got the chance to be a leader, too, she assured me. This teacher was kind and well-intentioned, but I wonder whether students like the young safety officer would be better off if we appreciated that not everyone aspires to be a leader in the conventional sense of the word, that some people wish to fit harmoniously into the group and others to be independent of it. Often the most highly creative people are in the latter category. As Janet Farrell and Leonie Kronborg wrote in Leadership Development for the Gifted and Talented, while extroverts tend to attain leadership in public domains, introverts tend to attain leadership in theoretical and aesthetic fields. Outstanding introverted leaders, such as Charles Darwin, Marie Curie, Patrick White, and Arthur Boyd, who have created either new fields of thought or rearranged existing knowledge, have spent long periods of their lives in solitude. Hence, leadership does not only apply in social situations, but also occurs in more solitary situations, such as developing new techniques in the arts, creating new philosophies, writing profound books, and making scientific breakthroughs. The new groupthink did not arise at one precise moment. Cooperative learning, corporate teamwork, and open office plans emerged at different times and for different reasons. But the mighty force that pulled these trends together was the rise of the World Wide Web, which lent both cool and gravitas to the idea of collaboration. On the Internet, wondrous creations were produced via shared brain power. Linux, the open-source operating system, Wikipedia, the online encyclopedia, MoveOn.org, the grassroots political movement. These collective productions, exponentially greater than the sum of their parts, were so awe-inspiring that we came to revere the hive mind, the wisdom of crowds, the miracle of crowdsourcing. Collaboration became a sacred concept, the key multiplier for success. But then we took things a step further than the facts called for. We came to value transparency and to knock down walls, not only online but also in person. We failed to realize that what makes sense for the asynchronous, relatively anonymous interactions of the Internet might not work as well inside the face-to-face, politically charged, acoustically noisy confines of an open-plan office. Instead of distinguishing between online and in-person interaction, we use the lessons of one to inform our thinking about the other. That's why, when people talk about aspects of the new group think, such as open office plans, they tend to invoke the Internet. Employees are putting their whole lives up on Facebook and Twitter and everywhere else anyway. There's no reason they should hide behind a cubicle wall. Dan LaFontaine, CFO of the social marketing firm Mr. Youth, told NPR. Another management consultant told me something similar. An office wall is exactly what it sounds like, a barrier. The fresher your methodologies of thinking, the less you want boundaries. The companies who use open office plans are new companies, just like the World Wide Web, which is still a teenager. The Internet's role in promoting face-to-face group work is especially ironic, because the early web was a medium that enabled bands of often introverted individualists, people much like the solitude-craving thought leaders Farrell and Kronborg describe, to come together to subvert and transcend the usual ways of problem-solving. A significant majority of the earliest computer enthusiasts were introverts, according to a study of 1,229 computer professionals working in the U.S., the U.K., and Australia between 1982 and 1984. It's a truism in tech that open source attracts introverts, says Dave W. Smith, a consultant and software developer in Silicon Valley, referring to the practice of producing software by opening the source code to the online public and allowing anyone to copy, improve upon, and distribute it. Many of these people were motivated by a desire to contribute to the broader good and to see their achievements recognized by a community they valued. But the earliest open-source creators didn't share office space. Often, they didn't even live in the same country. Their collaborations took place largely in the ether. This is not an insignificant detail. If you had gathered the same people who created Linux, installed them in a giant conference room for a year, and asked them to devise a new operating system, it's doubtful that anything so revolutionary would have occurred, for reasons we'll explore in the rest of this chapter. When the research psychologist Anders Ericsson was 15, he took up chess. He was pretty good at it, he thought, trouncing all his classmates during lunchtime matches. Until one day, a boy who'd been one of the worst players in the class started to win every match. Ericsson wondered what had happened. "I really thought about this a lot," he recalls in an interview with Daniel Coyle, author of The Talent Code. "Why could that boy whom I had beaten so easily now beat me just as easily? I knew he was studying, going to a chess club, but what had happened, really, underneath?" This is the question that drives Ericsson's career. How do extraordinary achievers get to be so great at what they do? Ericsson has searched for answers in fields as diverse as chess, tennis, and classical piano. In a now-famous experiment, he and his colleagues compared three groups of expert violinists at the elite music academy in West Berlin. The researchers asked the professors to divide the students into three groups: the best violinists, who had the potential for careers as international soloists, the good violinists, and a third group, training to be violin teachers rather than performers. Then they interviewed the musicians and asked them to keep detailed diaries of their time. They found a striking difference among the groups. All three groups spent the same amount of time, over 50 hours a week, participating in music-related activities. All three had similar classroom requirements, making demands on their time. But the two best groups spent most of their music-related time practicing in solitude, 24.3 hours a week, or 3.5 hours a day for the best group, compared with only 9.3 hours a week, or 1.3 hours a day for the worst group. The best violinists rated practice alone as the most important of all their music-related activities. Elite musicians, even those who perform in groups, describe practice sessions with their chamber group as leisure compared to solo practice, where the real work gets done. Ericsson and his cohorts found similar effects of solitude when they studied other kinds of expert performers. Serious study alone is the strongest predictor of skill for tournament-rated chess players, for example. Grandmasters typically spend a whopping 5,000 hours, almost five times as many hours as intermediate-level players, studying the game by themselves during their first 10 years of learning to play. College students who tend to study alone learn more over time than those who work in groups. Even elite athletes in team sports often spend unusual amounts of time in solitary practice. What's so magical about solitude? In many fields, Ericsson told me, it's only when you're alone that you can engage in deliberate practice, which he has identified as the key to exceptional achievement. When you practice deliberately, you identify the tasks or knowledge that are just out of your reach, strive to upgrade your performance, monitor your progress, and revise accordingly. Practice sessions that fall short of this standard are not only less useful, they're counterproductive. They reinforce existing cognitive mechanisms instead of improving them. Deliberate practice is best conducted alone for several reasons. It takes intense concentration, and other people can be distracting. It requires deep motivation, often self-generated. But most important, it involves working on the task that's most challenging to you personally. Only when you're alone, Ericsson told me, can you go directly to the part that's challenging to you. If you want to improve what you're doing, you have to be the one who generates the move. Imagine a group class. You're the one generating a move only a small percentage of the time. To see deliberate practice in action, we need look no further than the story of Stephen Wozniak. The homebrew meeting was the catalyst that inspired him to build that first PC, but the knowledge base and work habits that made it possible came from another place entirely. Woz had deliberately practiced engineering ever since he was a little kid. Ericsson says that it takes approximately 10,000 hours of deliberate practice to gain true expertise, so it helps to start young. In IWAS, Wozniak describes his childhood passion for electronics and unintentionally recounts all the elements of deliberate practice that Erickson emphasizes. First, he was motivated. His father, a Lockheed engineer, had taught Woz that engineers could change people's lives and were among the key people in the world. Second, he built his expertise step by painstaking step. Because he entered countless science fairs, he says, I acquired a central ability that was to help me through my entire career. Patience. I'm serious. Patience is usually so underrated. I mean, for all those projects, from third grade all the way to eighth grade, I just learned things gradually, figuring out how to put electronic devices together without so much as cracking a book. I learned to not worry so much about the outcome, but to concentrate on the step I was on, and to try to do it as perfectly as I could when I was doing it. Third, Woz often worked alone. This was not necessarily by choice. Like many technically inclined kids, he took a painful tumble down the social ladder when he got to junior high school. As a boy, he'd been admired for his science prowess, but now nobody seemed to care. He hated small talk, and his interests were out of step with those of his peers. A black-and-white photo from this period shows Woz, hair closely cropped, grimacing intensely, pointing proudly at his science fair-winning adder subtractor, a box-like contraption of wires, knobs, and gizmos. But the awkwardness of those years didn't deter him from pursuing his dream. It probably nurtured it. He would never have learned so much about computers, Woz says now, if he hadn't been too shy to leave the house. No one would choose this sort of painful adolescence, but the fact is that the solitude of Woz's teens and the single-minded focus on what would turn out to be a lifelong passion is typical for highly creative people. According to the psychologist Mihai Csikszentmihalyi, who between 1990 and 1995 studied the lives of 91 exceptionally creative people in the arts, sciences, business, and government, many of his subjects were on the social margins during adolescence, partly because intense curiosity or focused interest seems odd to their peers. Teens who are too gregarious to spend time alone often fail to cultivate their talents because practicing music or studying math requires a solitude they dread. Madeleine L'Engle, the author of the classic young adult novel A Wrinkle in Time and more than 60 other books, says that she would never have developed into such a bold thinker had she not spent so much of her childhood alone with books and ideas. As a young boy, Charles Darwin made friends easily, but preferred to spend his time taking long, solitary nature walks. As an adult, he was no different. My dear Mr. Babbage, he wrote to the famous mathematician who had invited him to a dinner party, I am very much obliged to you for sending me cards for your parties, but I am afraid of accepting them, for I should meet some people there to whom I have sworn by all the saints in heaven I never go out. But exceptional performance depends not only on the groundwork we lay through deliberate practice. It also requires the right working conditions. And in contemporary workplaces, these are surprisingly hard to come by. One of the side benefits of being a consultant is getting intimate access to many different work environments. Tom DeMarco, a principal of the Atlantic Systems Guild team of consultants, had walked around a good number of offices in his time, and he noticed that some workspaces were a lot more densely packed than others. He wondered what effect all that social interaction had on performance. To find out, DeMarco and his colleague, Timothy Lister, devised a study called the Coding War Games. The purpose of the games was to identify the characteristics of the best and worst computer programmers. More than 600 developers from 92 different companies participated. Each designed, coded, and tested a program, working in his normal office space during business hours. Each participant was also assigned a partner from the same company. The partners worked separately, however, without any communication, a feature of the games that turned out to be critical. When the results came in, they revealed an enormous performance gap. The best outperformed the worst by a 10-to-1 ratio. The top programmers were also about 2.5 times better than the median. When DeMarco and Lister tried to figure out what accounted for this astonishing range, the factors that you'd think would matter, such as years of experience, salary, even the time spent completing the work, had little correlation to outcome. Programmers with 10 years' experience did no better than those with 2 years. The half who performed above the median earned less than 10% more than the half below, even though they were almost twice as good. The programmers who turned in zero-defect work took slightly less, not more, time to complete the exercise than those who made mistakes. It was a mystery with one intriguing clue. Programmers from the same companies performed at more or less the same level, even though they hadn't worked together. That's because top performers overwhelmingly worked for companies that gave their workers the most privacy, personal space, control over their physical environments, and freedom from interruption. 62% of the best performers said that their workspace was acceptably private, compared to only 19% of the worst performers. 76% of the worst performers, but only 38% of the top performers, said that people often interrupted them needlessly. The coding war games are well known in tech circles, but DeMarco and Lister's findings reach beyond the world of computer programmers. A mountain of recent data on open plan offices from many different industries corroborates the results of the games. Open plan offices have been found to reduce productivity and impair memory. They're associated with high staff turnover. They make people sick, hostile, unmotivated, and insecure. Open plan workers are more likely to suffer from high blood pressure and elevated stress levels and to get the flu. They argue more with their colleagues. They worry about coworkers eavesdropping on their phone calls and spying on their computer screens. They have fewer personal and confidential conversations with colleagues. They're often subject to loud and uncontrollable noise, which raises heart rates, releases cortisol, the body's fight-or-flight stress hormone, and makes people socially distant, quick to anger, aggressive, and slow to help others. Indeed, excessive stimulation seems to impede learning. A recent study found that people learn better after a quiet stroll through the woods than after a noisy walk down a city street. Another study of 38,000 knowledge workers across different sectors found that the simple act of being interrupted is one of the biggest barriers to productivity. Even multitasking, that prized feat of modern-day office warriors, turns out to be a myth. Scientists now know that the brain is incapable of paying attention to two things at the same time. What looks like multitasking is really switching back and forth between multiple tasks, which reduces productivity and increases mistakes by up to 50%. Many introverts seem to know these things instinctively and resist being herded together. Backbone Entertainment, a video game design company in Oakland, California, initially used an open office plan, but found that their game developers, many of whom were introverts, were unhappy. It was one big warehouse space with just tables, no walls, and everyone could see each other, recalls Mike Micah, the former creative director. We switched over to cubicles and were worried about it. You'd think in a creative environment that people would hate that. But it turns out they prefer having nooks and crannies they can hide away in and just be away from everybody. Something similar happened at Reebok International when, in 2000, the company consolidated 1,250 employees in their new headquarters in Canton, Massachusetts. The managers assumed that their shoe designers would want office space with plenty of access to each other so they could brainstorm, an idea they probably picked up when they were getting their MBAs. Luckily, they consulted first with the shoe designers themselves, who told them that actually what they needed was peace and quiet so they could concentrate. This would not have come as news to Jason Fried, co-founder of the web application company 37 Signals. For 10 years, beginning in 2000, Fried asked hundreds of people, mostly designers, programmers, and writers, where they liked to work when they needed to get something done. He found that they went anywhere but their offices, which were too noisy and full of interruptions. That's why, of Fried's 16 employees, only 8 live in Chicago, where 37 Signals is based, and even they are not required to show up for work, even for meetings. Especially not for meetings, which Fried views as toxic. Fried is not anti-collaboration. 37 Signals' homepage touts its product's ability to make collaboration productive and pleasant. but he prefers passive forms of collaboration, like email, instant messaging, and online chat tools. His advice for other employers? Cancel your next meeting, he advises. Don't reschedule it. Erase it from memory. He also suggests no-talk Thursdays, one day a week, in which employees aren't allowed to speak to each other. The people Fried interviewed were saying out loud what creative people have always known. Kafka, for example, couldn't bear to be near even his adoring fiancé while he worked. You once said that you would like to sit beside me while I write. Listen, in that case, I could not write at all. For writing means revealing oneself to excess, that utmost of self-revelation and surrender, in which a human being, when involved with others, would feel he was losing himself, and from which, therefore, he will always shrink as long as he is in his right mind. That is why one can never be alone enough when one writes, why there can never be enough silence around one when one writes, why even night is not night enough. Even the considerably more cheerful Theodore Geisel, otherwise known as Dr. Seuss, spent his workdays ensconced in his private studio, the walls lined with sketches and drawings, in a bell tower outside his La Jolla, California house. Geisel was a much more quiet man than his jocular rhymes suggest. He rarely ventured out in public to meet his young readership, fretting that kids would expect a merry, outspoken, cat-in-the-hat-like figure and would be disappointed with his reserved personality. In mass, children terrify me, he admitted. If personal space is vital to creativity, so is freedom from peer pressure. Consider the story of the legendary advertising man Alex Osborne. Today, Osborne's name rings few bells, but during the first half of the 20th century, he was the kind of a larger-than-life Renaissance man who mesmerized his contemporaries. Osborne was a founding partner of the advertising agency Batten, Barton, Durstein & Osborne, BBDO. But it was as an author that he really made his mark. Beginning with the day in 1938 that a magazine editor invited him to lunch and asked what his hobby was. Imagination, replied Osborne. Mr. Osborne, said the editor, you must do a book on that. It's a job that has been waiting to be done all these years. There is no subject of greater importance. You must give it the time and energy and thoroughness it deserves. And so Mr. Osborne did. He wrote several books during the 1940s and 1950s, in fact, each tackling a problem that had vexed him in his capacity as head of BBDO. His employees were not creative enough. They had good ideas, Osborne believed, but were loath to share them for fear of their colleagues' judgment. For Osborne, the solution was not to have his employees work alone, but rather to remove the threat of criticism from group work. He invented the concept of brainstorming, a process in which group members generate ideas in a non-judgmental atmosphere. Brainstorming had four rules. 1. Don't judge or criticize ideas. 2. Be freewheeling. The wilder the idea, the better. 3. Go for quantity. The more ideas you have, the better. 4. Build on the ideas of fellow group members. Osborne believed passionately that groups, once freed from the shackles of social judgment, produced more and better ideas than did individuals working in solitude, and he made grand claims for his favored method. The quantitative results of group brainstorming are beyond question, he wrote. One group produced 45 suggestions for a home appliance promotion, 56 ideas for a money-raising campaign, 124 ideas on how to sell more blankets. In another case, 15 groups brainstormed one and the same problem and produced over 800 ideas. Osborne's theory had great impact, and company leaders took up brainstorming with enthusiasm. To this day, it's common for anyone who spends time in corporate America to find himself occasionally cooped up with colleagues in a room full of whiteboards, markers, and a preternaturally peppy facilitator encouraging everyone to free associate. There's only one problem with Osborne's breakthrough idea. Group brainstorming doesn't actually work. One of the first studies to demonstrate this was conducted in 1963. Marvin Danette, a psychology professor at the University of Minnesota, gathered 48 research scientists and 48 advertising executives, all of them male employees of Minnesota Mining and Manufacturing, otherwise known as 3M, inventors of the Post-it, and asked them to participate in both solitary and group brainstorming sessions. Dinette was confident that the executives would benefit from the group process. He was less sure that the research scientists, whom he considered more introverted, would profit from group work. Dinette divided each set of 48 men into 12 groups of four. Each foursome was given a problem to brainstorm, such as the benefits or difficulties that would arise from being born with an extra thumb. Each man was also given a similar problem to brainstorm on his own. Then Dinette and his team counted all the ideas, comparing those produced by the groups with those generated by people working individually. In order to compare apples with apples, Dinette pooled the ideas of each individual together with those of three other individuals, as if they had been working in nominal groups of four. The researchers also measured the quality of the ideas, rating them on a probability scale of 0 through 4. The results were unambiguous. The men in 23 of the 24 groups produced more ideas when they worked on their own than when they worked as a group. They also produced ideas of equal or higher quality when working individually. And the advertising executives were no better at group work than the presumably introverted research scientists. Since then, some 40 years of research has reached the same startling conclusion. Studies have shown that performance gets worse as group size increases. Groups of 9 generate fewer and poorer ideas compared to groups of 6, which do worse than groups of 4. The evidence from science suggests that business people must be insane to use brainstorming groups, writes the organizational psychologist Adrian Furnham. If you have talented and motivated people, they should be encouraged to work alone when creativity or efficiency is the highest priority. The one exception to this is online brainstorming. Groups brainstorming electronically, when properly managed, not only do better than individuals, research shows. The larger the group, the better it performs. The same is true of academic research. Professors who work together electronically from different physical locations tend to produce research that is more influential than those either working alone or collaborating face-to-face. This shouldn't surprise us. As we've said, it was the curious power of electronic collaboration that contributed to the new groupthink in the first place. What created Linux or Wikipedia, if not a gigantic electronic brainstorming session? But we're so impressed by the power of online collaboration that we've come to overvalue all group work at the expense of solo thought. We fail to realize that participating in an online working group is a form of solitude all its own. Instead, we assume that the success of online collaborations will be replicated in the face-to-face world. Indeed, after all these years of evidence that conventional brainstorming groups don't work, they remain as popular as ever. Participants in brainstorming sessions usually believe that their group performed much better than it actually did, which points to a valuable reason for their continued popularity. Group brainstorming makes people feel attached. A worthy goal, so long as we understand that social glue, as opposed to creativity, is the principal benefit. Psychologists usually offer 3 explanations for the failure of group brainstorming. The first is social loafing. In a group, some individuals tend to sit back and let others do the work. The second is production blocking. Only one person can talk or produce an idea at once, while the other group members are forced to sit passively. And the third is evaluation apprehension, meaning the fear of looking stupid in front of one's peers. Osborne's rules of brainstorming were meant to neutralize this anxiety, but studies show that the fear of public humiliation is a potent force. During the 1988-89 basketball season, for example, 2 NCAA basketball teams played 11 games without any spectators, owing to a measles outbreak that led their schools to quarantine all students. Both teams played much better, higher free throw percentages, for example, without any fans, even adoring home team fans, to unnerve them. The behavioral economist Dan Ariely noticed a similar phenomenon when he conducted a study asking 39 participants to solve anagram puzzles, either alone at their desks or with others watching. Ariely predicted that the participants would do better in public because they'd be more motivated, but they performed worse. An audience may be rousing, but it's also stressful. The problem with evaluation apprehension is that there's not much we can do about it. You'd think you could overcome it with will or training or a set of group process rules like Alex Osborne's. But recent research in neuroscience suggests that the fear of judgment runs much deeper and has more far-reaching implications than we ever imagined. Between 1951 and 1956, just as Osborne was promoting the power of group brainstorming, a psychologist named Solomon Asch conducted a series of now-famous experiments on the dangers of group influence. Asch gathered student volunteers into groups and had them take a vision test. He showed them a picture of three lines of varying lengths and asked questions about how the lines compared with one another, which was longer, which one matched the length of a fourth line, and so on. His questions were so simple that 95% of students answered every question correctly. But when Asch planted actors in the groups, and the actors confidently volunteered the same incorrect answer, the number of students who gave all correct answers plunged to 25%. That is, a staggering 75% of the participants went along with the group's wrong answer to at least one question. The Asch experiments demonstrated the power of conformity at exactly the time that Osborne was trying to release us from its chains. What they didn't tell us was why we were so prone to conform. What was going on in the minds of the cow towers? Had their perception of the line's lengths been altered by peer pressure? Or did they knowingly give wrong answers for fear of being the odd one out? For decades, psychologists puzzled over this question. Today, with the help of brain scanning technology, we may be getting closer to the answer. In 2005, an Emory University neuroscientist named Gregory Burns decided to conduct an updated version of Asch's experiments. Burns and his team recruited 32 volunteers, men and women between the ages of 19 and 41. The volunteers played a game in which each group member was shown two different three-dimensional objects on a computer screen and asked to decide whether the first object could be rotated to match the second. The experimenters used an fMRI scanner to take snapshots of the volunteers' brains as they conformed to or broke with group opinion. The results were both disturbing and illuminating. First, they corroborated Asch's findings. When the volunteers played the game on their own, they gave the wrong answer only 13.8% of the time. But when they played with a group whose members gave unanimously wrong answers, they agreed with the group 41% of the time. But Burns's study also shed light on exactly why we're such conformists. When the volunteers played alone, the brain scans showed activity in a network of brain regions, including the occipital cortex and parietal cortex, which are associated with visual and spatial perception, and in the frontal cortex, which is associated with conscious decision-making. But when they went along with their group's wrong answer, their brain activity revealed something very different. Remember, what Asch wanted to know was whether people conformed despite knowing that the group was wrong, or whether their perceptions had been altered by the group. If the former was true, Burns and his team reasoned, then they should see more brain activity in the decision-making prefrontal cortex. That is, the brain scans would pick up the volunteers deciding consciously to abandon their own beliefs to fit in with the group. But if the brain scans showed heightened activity in regions associated with visual and spatial perception, this would suggest that the group had somehow managed to change the individual's perceptions. That was exactly what happened. The conformists showed less brain activity in the frontal decision-making regions and more in the areas of the brain associated with perception. Peer pressure, in other words, is not only unpleasant, but can actually change your view of a problem. These early findings suggest that groups are like mind-altering substances. If the group thinks the answer is A, you are much more likely to believe that A is correct, too. It's not that you're saying consciously, I'm not sure, but they all think the answer's A, so I'll go with that. Nor are you saying, I want them to like me, so I'll just pretend that the answer's A. No, you are doing something much more unexpected and dangerous. Most of Burns' volunteers reported having gone along with the group because they thought that they had arrived serendipitously at the same correct answer. They were utterly blind, in other words, to how much their peers had influenced them. What does this have to do with social fear? Well, remember that the volunteers in the Ash and Burns studies didn't always conform. Sometimes they picked the right answer despite their peers' influence. And Burns and his team found something very interesting about these moments. They were linked to heightened activation in the amygdala, a small organ in the brain associated with upsetting emotions, such as the fear of rejection. Burns refers to this as the pain of independence, and it has serious implications. Many of our most important civic institutions, from elections to jury trials to the very idea of majority rule, depend on dissenting voices. But when the group is literally capable of changing our perceptions, and when to stand alone is to activate primitive, powerful, and unconscious feelings of rejection, then the health of these institutions seems far more vulnerable than we think. But of course, I've been simplifying the case against face-to-face collaboration. Steve Wozniak collaborated with Steve Jobs, after all. Without their pairing, there would be no Apple today. Every pair bond between mother and father, between parent and child, is an act of creative collaboration. Indeed, studies show that face-to-face interactions create trust in a way that online interactions can't. Research also suggests that population density is correlated with innovation. Despite the advantages of quiet walks in the woods, people in crowded cities benefit from the web of interactions that urban life offers. I've experienced this phenomenon personally. When I was getting ready to write this book, I carefully set up my home office, complete with uncluttered desk, file cabinets, free counter space, and plenty of natural light, and then felt too cut off from the world to type a single keystroke there. Instead, I wrote most of this book on a laptop at my favorite densely packed neighborhood cafe. I did this for exactly the reasons that champions of the new groupthink might suggest. The mere presence of other people helped my mind to make associative leaps. The coffee shop was full of people bent over their own computers, and if the expressions of rapt concentration on their faces were any indication, I wasn't the only one getting a lot of work done. But the cafe worked as my office because it had specific attributes that are absent from many modern schools and workplaces. It was social, yet its casual, come-and-go-as-you-please nature left me free from unwelcome entanglements and able to deliberately practice my writing. I could toggle back and forth between observer and social actor as much as I wanted. I could also control my environment. Each day, I chose the location of my table, in the center of the room or along the perimeter, depending on whether I wanted to be seen as well as to see. And I had the option to leave whenever I wanted peace and quiet to edit what I'd written that day. Usually, I was ready to exercise this right after only a few hours, not the 8, 10, or 14 hours that many office dwellers put in. The way forward, I'm suggesting, is not to stop collaborating face-to-face, but to refine the way we do it. For one thing, we should actively seek out symbiotic introvert-extrovert relationships in which leadership and other tasks are divided according to people's natural strengths and temperaments. The most effective teams are composed of a healthy mix of introverts and extroverts, studies show, and so are many leadership structures. We also need to create settings in which people are free to circulate in a shifting kaleidoscope of interactions and to disappear into their private workspaces when they want to focus or simply be alone. Our schools should teach children the skills to work with others. Cooperative learning can be effective when practiced well and in moderation. but also the time and training they need to deliberately practice on their own. It's also vital to recognize that many people, especially introverts like Steve Wozniak, need extra quiet and privacy in order to do their best work. Some companies are starting to understand the value of silence and solitude and are creating flexible open plans that offer a mix of solo workspaces, quiet zones, casual meeting areas, cafes, reading rooms, computer hubs, and even streets where people can chat casually with each other without interrupting others' workflow. At Pixar Animation Studios, the 16-acre campus is built around a football field-sized atrium, housing mailboxes, a cafeteria, and even bathrooms. The idea is to encourage as many casual, chance encounters as possible. At the same time, employees are encouraged to make their individual offices, cubicles, desks, and work areas their own, and to decorate them as they wish. Similarly, at Microsoft, many employees enjoy their own private offices, yet they come with sliding doors, movable walls, and other features that allow occupants to decide when they want to collaborate and when they need private time to think. These kinds of diverse workspaces benefit introverts as well as extroverts, the systems design researcher Matt Davis told me, because they offer more spaces to retreat to than traditional open plan offices. I suspect that Wozniak himself would approve of these developments. Before he created the Apple PC, Woz designed calculators at Hewlett-Packard, a job he loved in part because HP made it so easy to chat with others. Every day at 10 a.m. and 2 p.m., management wheeled in donuts and coffee, and people would socialize and swap ideas. What set these interactions apart was how low-key and relaxed they were. In iWoz, he recalls HP as a meritocracy, where it didn't matter what you looked like, where there was no premium on playing social games, and where no one pushed him from his beloved engineering work into management. That was what collaboration meant for Woz. The ability to share a donut and a brainwave with his laid-back, non-judgmental, poorly dressed colleagues who minded not a whit when he disappeared into his cubicle to get the real work done. Part 2. Your biology, yourself? Chapter 4. Is temperament destiny? Nature, nurture, and the orchid hypothesis. Some people are more certain of everything than I am of anything. Robert Rubin, In an Uncertain World. Almost 10 years ago. It's 2 a.m. I can't sleep, and I want to die. I'm not normally the suicidal type, but this is the night before a big speech, and my mind races with horrifying what-if propositions. What if my mouth dries up and I can't get any words out? What if I bore the audience? What if I throw up on stage? My boyfriend, now my husband, Ken, watches me toss and turn. He's bewildered by my distress. A former UN peacekeeper, he once was ambushed in Somalia, yet I don't think he felt as scared then as I do now. "Try to think of happy things," he says, caressing my forehead. I stare at the ceiling, tears welling. What happy things? Who could be happy in a world of podiums and microphones? "There are a billion people in China who don't give a rat's ass about your speech," Ken offers sympathetically. This helps for approximately 5 seconds. I turn over and watch the alarm clock. Finally, it's 6:30. At least the worst part, the night before part, is over. This time tomorrow, I'll be free. But first I have to get through today. I dress grimly and put on a coat. Ken hands me a sports water bottle filled with Bailey's Irish Cream. I'm not a big drinker, but I like Bailey's because it tastes like a chocolate milkshake. "Drink this 15 minutes before you go on," he says, kissing me goodbye. I take the elevator downstairs and settle into the car that waits to ferry me to my destination, a big corporate headquarters in suburban New Jersey. The drive gives me plenty of time to wonder how I allowed myself to get into this situation. I recently left my job as a Wall Street lawyer to start my own consulting firm. Mostly, I've worked one-on-one or in small groups, which feels comfortable. But when an acquaintance who is general counsel at a big media company asked me to run a seminar for his entire executive team, I agreed, enthusiastically even, for reasons I can't fathom now. I find myself praying for calamity, a flood or a small earthquake maybe, anything so I don't have to go through with this. Then I feel guilty for involving the rest of the city in my drama. The car pulls up at the client's office, and I step out, trying to project the peppy self-assurance of a successful consultant. The event organizer escorts me to the auditorium. I ask for directions to the bathroom, and in the privacy of the stall, gulp from the water bottle. For a few moments I stand still, waiting for the alcohol to work its magic. But nothing happens. I'm still terrified. Maybe I should take another swig. No, it's only 9 in the morning. What if they smell the liquor on my breath? I reapply my lipstick and make my way back to the event room, where I arrange my note cards at the podium as the room fills with important-looking business people. Whatever you do, try not to vomit, I tell myself. Some of the executives glance up at me, but most of them stare fixedly at their BlackBerries. Clearly, I'm taking them away from very pressing work. How am I going to hold their attention long enough for them to stop pounding out urgent communiques into their tiny typewriters? I vow, right then and there, that I will never make another speech. Well, since then, I've given plenty of them. I haven't completely overcome my anxiety, but over the years I've discovered strategies that can help anyone with stage fright who needs to speak in public. More about that in Chapter 5. In the meantime, I've told you my tale of abject terror because it lies at the heart of some of my most urgent questions about introversion. On some deep level, my fear of public speaking seems connected to other aspects of my personality that I appreciate, especially my love of all things gentle and cerebral. This strikes me as a not uncommon constellation of traits. But are they truly connected, and if so, how? Are they the result of nurture, the way I was raised? Both of my parents are soft-spoken, reflective types. My mother hates public speaking, too. Or are they my nature? Something deep in my genetic makeup? I've been puzzling over these questions for my entire adult life. Fortunately, so have researchers at Harvard, where scientists are probing the human brain in an attempt to discover the biological origins of human temperament. One such scientist is an 82-year-old man named Jerome Kagan, one of the great developmental psychologists of the 20th century. Kagan devoted his career to studying the emotional and cognitive development of children. In a series of groundbreaking longitudinal studies, he followed children from infancy through adolescence, documenting their physiologies and personalities along the way. Longitudinal studies like these are time-consuming, expensive, and therefore rare. But when they pay off, as Kagan's did, they pay off big. For one of those studies, launched in 1989 and still ongoing, Professor Kagan and his team gathered 500 four-month-old infants in his laboratory for child development at Harvard, predicting they'd be able to tell, on the strength of a 45-minute evaluation, which babies were more likely to turn into introverts or extroverts. If you've seen a four-month-old baby lately, this may seem an audacious claim. But Kagan had been studying temperament for a long time, and he had a theory. Kagan and his team exposed the four-month-olds to a carefully chosen set of new experiences. The infants heard tape-recorded voices and balloons popping, saw colorful mobiles dance before their eyes, and inhaled the scent of alcohol on cotton swabs. They had wildly varying reactions to the new stimuli. About 20% cried lustily and pumped their arms and legs. Kagan called this group high reactive. About 40% stayed quiet and placid, moving their arms or legs occasionally, but without all the dramatic limb pumping. This group Kagan called low reactive. The remaining 40% fell between these two extremes. In a startlingly counterintuitive hypothesis, Kagan predicted that it was the infants in the high reactive group, the lusty arm pumpers, who were most likely to grow into quiet teenagers. When they were 2, 4, 7, and 11 years old, many of the children returned to Kagan's lab for follow-up testing of their reactions to new people and events. At the age of 2, the children met a lady wearing a gas mask and a lab coat, a man dressed in a clown costume, and a radio-controlled robot. At 7, they were asked to play with kids they'd never met before. At 11, an unfamiliar adult interviewed them about their personal lives. Kagan's team observed how the children reacted to these strange situations, noting their body language and recording how often and spontaneously they laughed, talked, and smiled. They also interviewed the kids and their parents about what the children were like outside the laboratory. Did they prefer one or two close friends to a merry band? Did they like visiting new places? Were they risk-takers, or were they more cautious? Did they consider themselves shy or bold? Many of the children turned out exactly as Kagan had expected. The high-reactive infants, the 20% who'd hollered at the mobiles bobbing above their heads, were more likely to have developed serious, careful personalities. The low-reactive infants, the quiet ones, were more likely to have become relaxed and confident types. High and low reactivity tended to correspond, in other words, to introversion and extroversion. As Kagan mused in his 1998 book Galen's Prophecy, Carl Jung's descriptions of the introvert and extrovert, written over 75 years ago, apply with uncanny accuracy to a proportion of our high and low reactive adolescents. Kagan describes two of those adolescents, reserved Tom and extroverted Ralph, and the differences between the two are striking. Tom, who was unusually shy as a child, is good at school, watchful and quiet, devoted to his girlfriend and parents, prone to worry, and loves learning on his own and thinking about intellectual problems. He plans to be a scientist. Like other famous introverts who were shy children, writes Kagan, comparing Tom to T.S. Eliot and the mathematician-philosopher Alfred North Whitehead, Tom has chosen a life of the mind. Ralph, in contrast, is relaxed and self-assured. He engages the interviewer from Kagan's team as a peer, not as an authority figure 25 years his senior. Though Ralph is very bright, he recently failed his English and science classes because he'd been goofing around. But nothing much bothers Ralph. He admits his flaws cheerfully. Psychologists often discuss the difference between temperament and personality. Temperament refers to inborn, biologically based behavioral and emotional patterns that are observable in infancy and early childhood. Personality is the complex brew that emerges after cultural influence and personal experience are thrown into the mix. Some say that temperament is the foundation and personality is the building. Kagan's work helped link certain infant temperaments with adolescent personality styles, like those of Tom and Ralph. But how did Kagan know that the arm-thrashing infants would likely turn into cautious, reflective teens like Tom, or that the quiet babies were more likely to become forthright, too-cool-for-school Ralphs? The answer lies in their physiologies. In addition to observing the children's behaviors in strange situations, Kagan's team measured their heart rates, blood pressure, finger temperature, and other properties of the nervous system. Kagan chose these measures because they're believed to be controlled by a potent organ inside the brain called the amygdala. The amygdala is located deep in the limbic system, an ancient brain network found even in primitive animals like mice and rats. This network, sometimes called the emotional brain, underlies many of the basic instincts we share with these animals, such as appetite, sex drive, and fear. The amygdala serves as the brain's emotional switchboard, receiving information from the senses and then signaling the rest of the brain and nervous system how to respond. One of its functions is to instantly detect new or threatening things in the environment, from an airborne frisbee to a hissing serpent, and send rapid-fire signals through the body that trigger the fight-or-flight response. When the frisbee looks like it's headed straight for your nose, it's your amygdala that tells you to duck. When the rattlesnake prepares to bite, it's the amygdala that makes sure you run. Kagan hypothesized that infants born with an especially excitable amygdala would wiggle and howl when shown unfamiliar objects, and grow up to be children who were more likely to feel vigilant when meeting new people. And this is just what he found. In other words, the four-month-olds who thrashed their arms like punk rockers did so not because they were extroverts in the making, but because their little bodies reacted strongly. They were high reactive to new sights, sounds, and smells. The quiet infants were silent not because they were future introverts, just the opposite, but because they had nervous systems that were unmoved by novelty. The more reactive a child's amygdala, the higher his heart rate is likely to be, the more widely dilated his eyes, the tighter his vocal cords, the more cortisol, a stress hormone, in his saliva, the more jangled he's likely to feel when he confronts something new and stimulating. As high reactive infants grow up, they continue to confront the unknown in many different contexts, from visiting an amusement park for the first time to meeting new classmates on the first day of kindergarten. We tend to notice most a child's reaction to unfamiliar people. How does he behave on the first day of school? Does she seem uncertain at birthday parties full of kids she doesn't know? But what we're really observing is a child's sensitivity to novelty in general, not just to people. High and low reactivity are probably not the only biological routes to introversion and extroversion. There are plenty of introverts who do not have the sensitivity of a classic high reactive, and a small percentage of high reactives grow up to be extroverts. Still, Kagan's decades-long series of discoveries mark a dramatic breakthrough in our understanding of these personality styles, including the value judgments we make. Extroverts are sometimes credited with being pro-social, meaning caring about others, and introverts disparaged as people who don't like people. But the reactions of the infants in Kagan's tests had nothing to do with people. These babies were shouting, or not shouting, over Q-tips. They were pumping their limbs or staying calm in response to popping balloons. The high-reactive babies were not misanthropes in the making. They were simply sensitive to their environments. Indeed, the sensitivity of these children's nervous systems seems to be linked not only to noticing scary things, but to noticing in general. High-reactive children pay what one psychologist calls alert attention to people and things. They literally use more eye movements than others to compare choices before making a decision. It's as if they process more deeply, sometimes consciously, sometimes not, the information they take in about the world. In one early series of studies, Kagan asked a group of first graders to play a visual matching game. Each child was shown a picture of a teddy bear sitting on a chair, alongside six other similar pictures, only one of which was an exact match. The high-reactive children spent more time than others considering all the alternatives and were more likely to make the right choice. When Kagan asked these same kids to play word games, he found that they also read more accurately than impulsive children did. High-reactive kids also tend to think and feel deeply about what they've noticed and to bring an extra degree of nuance to everyday experiences. This can be expressed in many different ways. If the child is socially oriented, she may spend a lot of time pondering her observations of others. Why Jason didn't want to share his toys today. Why Mary got so mad at Nicholas when he bumped into her accidentally. If he has a particular interest in solving puzzles, making art, building sandcastles, he'll often concentrate with unusual intensity. If a high-reactive toddler breaks another child's toy by mistake, studies show, she often experiences a more intense mix of guilt and sorrow than a lower reactive child would. All kids notice their environments and feel emotions, of course, but high reactive kids seem to see and feel things more. If you ask a high reactive 7-year-old how a group of kids should share a coveted toy, writes the science journalist Winifred Gallagher, he'll tend to come up with sophisticated strategies like alphabetize their last names and let the person closest to A go first. Putting theory into practice is hard for them, writes Gallagher, because their sensitive natures and elaborate schemes are unsuited to the heterogeneous rigors of the schoolyard. Yet, as we'll see in the chapters to come, these traits, alertness, sensitivity to nuance, complex emotionality, turn out to be highly underrated powers. Kagan has given us painstakingly documented evidence that high reactivity is one biological basis of introversion.